exercise was to find a consistent Hamiltonian formulation of such a system which has symmetries. And in order that the system stays on the constraint surface, one finds that in general, the initial system of constraints has to be supplied by more constraints. And these additional constraints, I forgot to mention, the additional constraints we found, and there were r prime minus r of them, are called secondary constraints. We also said what is a first class function. Just to recall, that's some function f on the phase space, which has the property that phi j on the constraint surface, on the final constraint surface that was found, is equal to zero for all j running from 1 to r prime.
Does it matter which constraint emerges as secondary constraint and which emerges as primary constraint?
Well, the set of primary constraints is unique, and the set of secondary constraints is also unique. I mean, you can multiply. you can't get the secondary before the primary ones. Is that the question? Or I mean, the primary ones are defined by the Lagrangian, and the other ones come out from this algorithm.
But anyway, we take into account all of them.
We take into account all of them, yeah. Okay. Now, the constraints are now, so we have a subdivision of the set of constraints into primary and secondary, but there's a more useful subdivision of these constraints into what they call first and second class constraints. First class constraint C mu has this property. And the second class constraint, let me call it phi I, has a property even on the constraint surface that it doesn't have vanishing Poisson brackets for some j equal to 1 to r prime. And one can show the number of second class constraints is always even, and the matrix with entries m, I, j is equal to phi I, phi j is invertible. So this is an anti-symmetric matrix. So in order to be invertible, it has to be of even dimension. So it's consistent. Definition. So F is called an observable sometimes called a Dirac observable, if and only if f, comma, c mu is equal to 0. So, yeah?
This condition for fij on c or everywhere?
This one? This condition?
This
is a definition. This is holding everywhere. C mu is a first class constraint, and this is a second class constraint. So this is second class constraint. So C mu's are first class, and phi with capital Latin letters are second class constraints.
So it means that it's an observable if it's with all the first
class. Only with the first class constraints. Yeah. With all of them, yeah, for all mu. Secondly, and we'll see why this is the case. This C mu's are also called. Generators of gauge transformations. And thirdly, I want to define so-called Dirac bracket. Which is defined as f comma g star is equal to just the normal Poisson bracket minus f minus f comma phi I m I j phi j g. And the matrix with upper indices is the inverse of this matrix. Inverse of MIJ. So let me first explain why you don't impose this condition for all the constraints. Why do we impose one, or do we require one only for C mu, not phi i's? Because this condition is inconsistent. Suppose that f, comma phi I, you require that this is equal to 0 and also equal to 0 with respect to f, comma phi j, then certainly it is also true that phi I, comma phi j, comma f is equal to 0, because this is already 0. But now you can apply the Jacobi identity and write this or you consider this quantity, phi j, phi I, comma f. So this term vanishes by assumption, this term vanishes by assumption, so this should be 0. And now, by the Jacobi identity, this is equal to plus or minus, I forgot which one, phi I, comma phi j, comma f, which is, by definition, mij. F. But MIJ may not be any constraint at all. it may be not even equal to be phi I, to proportional to any of the constraints. So this, in general, is different from zero. At least it doesn't vanish by the assumption. So f, if it would satisfy this and this condition, it has to also satisfy this condition. So f has to satisfy more conditions than you assumed. So you can turn the crank and make computations like this, and you generate more and more and more conditions until you finally probably find that f is has to be a constant. So that's, of course, not very interesting. Pardon me? The number of the phi.
There could be one.
Pardon me?
There could be one phi I.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the Poisson bracket of phi I would be zero. And there could be some problems with your proof. But I understand that the number is even.
No, of course, I and j have to be different. Yeah. So I need at least two. The two is anyway the minimal number of second class constraints that I have. Okay, so why are the CMUs called generators of gauge transformations? This is because the Hamiltonian H prime was given by some expression of the form H tilde plus our V mu C mu. This we derived last time. We are only, I said also last time that automatically, these constraints which finally appear in this Hamiltonian are only first-class constraints. So now we compute the time evolution of some object, f dot. I was asked yesterday to make a big dot over things. So f dot has to be equal to h prime f. So this has this first term here, h tilde, comma f. Plus the second term, v mu, comma, c mu, comma f. But the problem is that these guys here, these are Lagrange multipliers. You can choose them any way you want. I mean, nobody tells you how to choose them. They are not dynamical. They are just things that you can choose as you want. So if this is your Hamiltonian, unfortunately, it is our Hamiltonian. The time evolution of some quantity f is ambiguous. It's ambiguous by this quantity. So in order to avoid ambiguities, one has to ask that f has vanishing Poisson bracket with this thing, which is why we call f to be an observable. And secondly, to explain, the transformations on the phase space defined by Hamiltonian is always the time evolution, right? So now we can ask what is the interpretation of the transformations generated by these first class constraints. And it turns out, and in order to get used to this, one should really look at examples, which I will do in a moment. And there you can see that these transformations are really gauge transformations. So they incorporate in the Hamiltonian picture the symmetries that the original Lagrangian had. For example, if you take Maxwell theory and you run this procedure, you find out that the constraint, which in this case is the Gauss constraint, the Gauss law, generates U1 gauge transformations. Okay. So what about this Dirac bracket? The Dirac bracket is there in order to deal with this nasty second-class constraints, which we don't like at all because they lead to inconsistencies. So the observation is the following. The Dirac bracket almost satisfies all the properties of the normal Poisson bracket. So for example, you can show the following thing. So f, g, well, first of all, it's anti-symmetric. G, f star. Secondly, satisfies the Jacobi identity, f, g, G, H star star plus G, H comma F star star plus H comma F comma G star star is equal to 0. This is actually a non, it's a one-page calculation to show this. And thirdly, and this is the most interesting property, if you can, if you have any function f, and you take the the Dirac bracket with respect to some secondary class constraint, then it's identically 0. And also, it's identically, the other nice thing is that F and G star is equal to F comma G if at least one of F and G is first class. So this is very important because the Dirac bracket therefore doesn't change the equations of motion because the Hamiltonian in particular is a first class function. So the F dot, if G is equal to the Hamiltonian, then F star is F comma H star is the same as F comma G, which is by definition F dot. So that is important. The other property, this one means that it is consistent with respect to the Dirac bracket to solve these secondary class constraints before or after you evaluate the Poisson bracket.
You mean the second class
constraints? I just mean the second class constraints, yeah.
And what about this bracket with the first class constraint?
The first class constraints, if G is a first class constraint, then this is also equal to this because of the first class property. It's just the same, yeah. So 3 means that it is consistent to solve phi I equal to 0 before or after evaluating F comma G star. So either you solve the constraint before, then you put the solution into F and G, and you then you evaluate the Poisson bracket, or you do it afterwards. Doesn't matter. And that means that so the prescription is when you have second class constraint, solve this second class constraint classically and proceed with the Dirac bracket. But I want to say some word of caution. Even if F and G are observables, so observable means wrenching a Poisson bracket with the first class constraints only, that's less to require than to ask that they are first class, because first class means that they have vanishing Poisson brackets with all constraints, then F comma G star is not equal to F comma G. And that sometimes spoils many things, because if you have managed to, if you have a nice Poisson bracket between certain functions, like a nice Poisson bracket between momentum and configuration coordinates, which is usually just some constant. With respect to the Poisson bracket, I'm sorry, there should be one, not equal. With respect to the Dirac bracket, that could be something very complicated because of this nasty matrix Mij that might be there. So if you have second class constraints, your theory becomes in general much more complicated. So you want to avoid that. Yes. If you take, you want what kind of example you want?
An easy one.
Pardon me? An easy one. Okay. Second class constraint. So the, usually this second class constraints are typical for field theories. So I have to go to some field theory example. Are you familiar with the Palatini formulation of general relativity? If you take the Palatini formulation, this is an example with second class constraints. There may be an easier one, but I just don't have one in my head right now.
The Broca Lagrangian?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, Broca. That's good. Mm-hmm. I was. Let me just write it for you. Anyway, I was going to mention that. So if you want to get used to this, one should work out some examples. We can maybe do it together before or after one of those lectures. No? Examples, p-brain actions. So M is some, let's say, n-dimensional Minkowski space. Minkowski space. So, and we have a Minkowski metric on here. Mu nu run from 0 to some n minus 1. And then you have some coordinates or some embedding functions or fields. X mu, which depend on tau and sigma 1 to sigma p. So this is an embedding of some p-dimensional object into some n-dimensional target space. So target space. So p equal to 0 is the embedding of a line. P equal to 2 is a string. P equal to 3 would be a membrane, and so on and so forth. So now you define HAB is equal to the pullback of the Minkowski metric under this embedding coordinates. So in other words, eta mu nu, x mu comma A, x nu comma B. And then you define the volume, the world volume of these objects as your action. So this is now, if you call this coordinates y, we have dpy square root determinant of h. So this is the action of a relativistic particle for p equal to 0. P here should be 1, yeah, thank you. P equal to 0 is the relativistic particle. P equal to 1 is the Nambu-Goto string. And P equal to 2 and higher is some membrane or p-brain actions. And these are actually, when you now go through this exercise, do the Legendre transformation, consider primary, secondary, first, and second class constraints, you find that these are all examples with only first class constraints. Now consider a second example, which is action of vector bosons. So S is equal to minus 1/4 d4x f mu nu minus 1/2 m squared d4x a mu. So we are again in four-dimensional Minkowski space. So the metric, the indices here are pooled with this Minkowski metric. And for m equal to 0, this is pure Maxwell. For m not equal to 0, this is called Proker theory. And these two cases are the case m equal to 0 is really singular, because if m is not equal to 0, then and f mu is, of course, the curvature of this connection A. So it's d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. So if m is not equal to 0, or let's first discuss the Maxwell case. If m is equal to 0, so if this case, if this term is not there, then this action is invariant under a mu goes to a mu minus d mu f for some function f. So if a changes by an exact form, then the Maxwell action is left invariant, because, well, there's this antisymmetric derivatives acting on f. And if f is twice differentiable, which I assume here, then this action is left invariant. If m is not equal to 0, then this is not the case. Not invariant. And in fact, you can show that m equal to 0 has only a first class constraint. M is not equal to 0. There are first and second class constraints. Oh, actually, no, there's only second class constraint. And just as a hint, if you want to work this out in detail, the matrix Mij here, in this case, is proportional to m squared, which is not very surprising. So this was the matrix that, matrix that enters the Dirac bracket. So, and as an important consequence of this is that in Maxwell theory, there are only 2 degrees of freedom, 2 propagating degrees of freedom. In Proker theory, there are 3. Three observable fields.
What happens for Dirac-Lagrangian?
Dirac-Lagrangian? If you add fermion terms?
I mean only Dirac, only fermions.
Only fermions. There are no constraints, no. In order to make this to get some symmetry.
It's not invertible, the momentum.
No, if you just mean psi bar d slash psi.
Exactly.
Yeah, this action is not invariant under U1 gauge transformations.
Yes,
if d is just the normal d.
Yes.
If you add a vector potential, then of course it has U1 gauge transformations.
Yeah, I mean,
You want to know what are the first class constraints in this theory if you add a vector potential?
No, I mean, does it have a second class constraint or not?
This one?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't.
Because if you come to the momentum, when you get to psi,
So fermions are a little bit strange because you find that among the what you think is configuration coordinates, there are also momentum coordinates. So the fermion is its own momentum as in a sense.
Oh, it's okay. It's my question.
Yeah. Do you remember when I started?
I'm just wondering. I think it was 31 minutes ago.
31, oh, thank you. So I have 15 minutes to go. So let me say something about Dirac observables. So I assume that we got rid of second class constraints.
How can you get rid of them?
By explicitly solving them.
But usually you cannot solve them. Can you solve them?
So in general, I mean, in principle, you can always solve them.
In principle.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that. Let me assume it. I mean, it's practically sometimes difficult. That's true, but it's in principle possible. So assume that we got rid of second-class constraints. So only first-class constraints left. Mu left, and let's call the associated Dirac bracket again. Let's just denote it by the normal Poisson bracket again. Otherwise, I will always forget the star. Okay. Then. The question is, how can I get, is there a general theory for getting this very important Dirac observables, which are the gauge invariant things that I have? So for example, here in this theory, f mu is a Dirac observable because it's invariant under gauge transformations. And magnetic and electric fields into which this decomposes are obviously the observables in Maxwell theory. So how is there a general framework for getting those observables? The answer is yes, at least locally. Local construction. Locally in phase space. And the trick here is to do the following. At least locally, okay, let me first introduce some notation. So we are left. So we had phase space variables QA and PA last time. Okay, and before we had, now we split these variables into systems of canonical pairs. QA, PA, and let's call them QI and PI. And before, and we have in principle second class constraints, CI1 and CI2. Phi2. And what I assume here on this left blackboard that I solve these constraints for QI and PI. So QI and PI are some functions of QA and PA. So we got rid of these functions. So all, the only thing that is left is this. This is the only interesting thing left. And we are left with this C mu constraints. Now I can, in principle, again, locally in phase space, I can solve them in the form P mu plus H mu equal to 0. So I'm doing a second split of QA and PA into, now I'm running out of indices, Q mu and P mu, and some other set of variables, let's call them U, QI and PI. So I'm splitting this into these two sets of canonical pairs. And in principle, I can solve this first class constraints always in this form, where H mu in general is a function of QI, PI, and also of Q mu. Now, you can show a couple of nice results. Let me call these constraints now by C prime mu. So they are, at least locally in phase space, they are equivalent to C mu equal to 0, but they have a different form. And what now holds is the following thing. C prime mu, comma C prime mu is equal to 0 for all mu nu. So that is nice, because before we only knew that C mu, comma C nu, I said last time that they form a subalgebra. So there was some function f mu nu rho, C rho, which relates the Poisson bracket between two first class constraints to, again, to a first class constraint. And these are called structure functions. And this might be very complicated in general. With respect to these new constraints, of an equivalent set of constraints, these first class constraints form an abelian algebra. No, this holds on the full phase space.
And what about this form C prime mu?
C prime mu, yeah. What about it?
Oh, okay. So
you said this could be done locally, but right now we have nothing which is local.
No, I mean, when you solve this constraint, which may be a very complicated function of P, then you have usually This holds on some patch of the phase space. There might be other patches where it looks different. That's what I mean by local. So, and because of this, the following object is a Dirac observable. Let f be any function on phase space. Let tau mu be any real number such that tau mu is in the range of q mu. So it's some value that the function q mu can take. Then OF of tau. Let me first write it, then I explain. Okay, so we have these primed constraints, and I'm considering the so-called Hamiltonian vector field associated with C prime U. And this property makes sure that these vector fields commute with each other. Now, we have here a sum over all possible numbers, n mu, 1, 2, 3, and so on, all possible non-negative integers. And then we have this kind of factorial factor here, some powers of tau mu minus q mu, and then these products of vector fields applied to F. The claim is that this is a Dirac observable. So let me write it here. So this shows that locally in phase space, Dirac observables can always be constructed, although there are, of course, convergence issues with this formula. So this has to be analyzed in a case-by-case study. This formula looks, like, of course, very complicated, but there's a nice situation in which it simplifies. Suppose that h mu is only a function of qi and pi, independent of q mu. Then OF of tau is equal to the n-fold Poisson bracket between f, so n times h tau, where h tau is given by sum over all mu, tau mu minus q mu h mu. And whenever this happens, we say that we have a situation in which the system deparametrizes. Fourthly, also, if we have d deparameterization. Then dOf of tau by d t mu is equal to h mu comma OF of tau. I should mention, I try to always do that if I talk about some work that has been done by somebody in the audience. So this is called the framework or the relational formalism, because what is the interpretation of 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 tau? OF of tau is the value of the function f when the functions q mu take the value tau mu, because, and you can see this most easily here, if q mu is equal to tau mu, then this whole series breaks down after the zero step. So then, OF of tau when q is equal to tau is equal to f, right? So the whole series stops at the zeroth order term. So you could say that, and one calls sometimes q mu is called a clock with respect to the constraint c prime mu. You could say that f is a or OF of tau is a relational object in the sense that, it takes a certain value when certain other things take certain values. This is called the relational point of view or framework, and was first introduced, as far as I know, by Carlo Rovelli. And these kind of formulas that I wrote down here have been found by Bianca Dittrich, who was my ex-PhD student. So I think it's a good time to stop now. So we'll continue later then. Thank you.